Kent is the most famous of the seven Saxon kingdoms, because the Christian religion was preached to the Saxons there, who domineered over the Britons too much to care for what they said about their religion, or anything else, by Augustine, a monk from Rome. King Ethelbert, of Kent, was soon converted, and the moment he said he was a Christian, his courtiers all said they were Christians, after which, 10,000 of his subjects said they were Christians too. Augustine built a little church, close to this King Otiames' palace, on the grounds now occupied by the beautiful Cathedral of Canterbury. Sebert, the King Otiames' nephew, built on a muddy marshy place near London, where there had been a temple to Apollo, a church dedicated to St. Peter, which is now Westminster Abbey. And, in London itself, on the foundation of a temple to Diana, he built another little church which has risen up, since that old time, to be St. Paul Otiames. After the death of Ethelbert, Edwin, King of Northumbria, who was such a good king that it was said a woman or child might openly carry a purse of gold, in his reign, without fear, allowed his child to be baptized, and held a great council to consider whether he and his people should all be Christians or not. It was decided that they should be. Coifi, the chief priest of the old religion, made a great speech on the occasion. In this discourse, he told the people that he had found out the old gods to be impostors. I am quite satisfied of it, Atm, he said. Look at me. I have been serving them all my life, and they have done nothing for me, whereas, if they had been really powerful, they could not have decently done less, in return for all I have done for them, than make my fortune. As they have never made my fortune, I am quite convinced they are impostors. Atm, when this singular priest had finished speaking, he hastily armed himself with sword and lance, mounted a war horse, rode at a furious gallop in sight of all the people to the temple, and flung his lance against it as an insult. From that time, the Christian religion spread itself among the Saxons, and became their faith. The next very famous prince was Egbert. He lived about 150 years afterwards, and claimed to have a better right to the throne of Wessex than Beutric, another Saxon prince who was at the head of that kingdom, and who married Edburga, the daughter of Offa, king of another of the seven kingdoms. This Queen Edburga was a handsome murderess, who poisoned people when they offended her. One day, she mixed a cup of poison for a certain noble belonging to the court, but her husband drank of it too, by mistake, and died. Upon this, the people revolted, in great crowds, and running to the palace, and thundering at the gates, cried, "Down with the wicked queen, who poisons men!" Atm, they drove her out of the country, and abolished the title she had disgraced. When years had passed away, some travellers came home from Italy, and said that in the town of Pavia they had seen a ragged beggar woman, who had once been handsome, but was then shrivelled, bent, and yellow, wandering about the streets, crying for bread, and that this beggar woman was the poisoning English queen. It was, indeed, Edburga, and so she died, without a shelter for her wretched head. Egbert, not considering himself safe in England, in consequence of his having claimed the crown of Wessex, for he thought his rival might take him prisoner and put him to death, sought refuge at the court of Charlemagne, King of France. On the death of Beutric, so unhappily poisoned by mistake, Egbert came back to Britain, succeeded to the throne of Wessex, conquered some of the other monarchs of the seven kingdoms, added their territories to his own, and, for the first time, called the country over which he ruled, England. And now, new enemies arose, who, for a long time, troubled England sorely. These were the Northmen, the people of Denmark and Norway, whom the English called the Danes. They were a warlike people, quite at home upon the sea, not Christians, very daring and cruel. They came over in ships, and plundered and burned wheresoever they landed. Once, they beat Egbert in battle. Once, Egbert beat them. But, they cared no more for being beaten than the English themselves. In the four following short reigns, of Ethelwulf, and his sons, Ethelbald, Ethelbert, and Ethelred, they came back, over and over again, burning and plundering, and laying England waste. In the last mentioned reign, they seized Edmund, King of East England, and bound him to a tree. Then, they proposed to him that he should change his religion, but he, being a good Christian, steadily refused. Upon that, they beat him, made cowardly jests upon him, all defenseless as he was, shot arrows at him, and, finally, struck off his head. It is impossible to say whose head they might have struck off next, but for the death of King Ethelred from a wound he had received in fighting against them, and the succession to his throne of the best and wisest king that ever lived in England. Chapter EO England under the good Saxon, Alfred. Alfred the Great was a young man, 23 years of age, when he became king. Twice in his childhood, he had been taken to Rome, where the Saxon nobles were in the habit of going on journeys which they supposed to be religious, and, once, he had stayed for some time in Paris. Learning, however, was so little cared for, then, that at 12 years old he had not been taught to read, although, of the sons of King Ethelwulf, he, the youngest, was the favourite. But he had, as most men who grow up to be great and good are generally found to have had, an excellent mother, and, one day, this lady, whose name was Osburga, happened, as she was sitting among her sons, to read a book of Saxon poetry. The art of printing was not known until long and long after that period, and the book, which was written, was what is called a illuminated, ATM with beautiful bright letters, richly painted. The brothers admiring it very much, their mother said, "I will give it to that one of you four princes who first learns to read." ATM Alfred sought out a tutor that very day, applied himself to learn with great diligence, and soon won the book. He was proud of it, all his life. This great king, in the first year of his reign, fought 9 battles with the Danes. He made some treaties with them too, by which the false Danes swore they would quit the country. They pretended to consider that they had taken a very solemn oath, in swearing this upon the holy bracelets that they wore, and which were always buried with them when they died, but they cared little for it, for they thought nothing of breaking oaths and treaties too, as soon as it suited their purpose, and coming back again to fight, plunder, and burn, as usual. One fatal winter, in the 4th year of King Alfred ATM's reign, they spread themselves in great numbers over the whole of England, and so dispersed and routed the King ATM's soldiers that the king was left alone, and was obliged to disguise himself as a common peasant, and to take refuge in the cottage of one of his cowherds who did not know his face. Here, King Alfred, while the Danes sought him far and near, was left alone one day, by the cowherd ATM's wife, to watch some cakes which he put to bake upon the hearth. But, being at work upon his bow and arrows, with which he hoped to punish the false Danes when a brighter time should come, and thinking deeply of his poor unhappy subjects whom the Danes chased through the land, his noble mind forgot the cakes, and they were burned. "A what, ATM," said the cowherd ATM's wife, who scolded him well when she came back, and little thought she was scolding the king, "you will be ready enough to eat them by and by, and yet you cannot watch them, idle dog." ATM. At length, the Devonshire men made head against a new host of Danes who landed on their coast, killed their chief, and captured their flag, on which was represented the likeness of a ravener, or very fit bird for a thievish army like that, I think. The loss of their standard troubled the Danes greatly, for they believed it to be enchanted or woven by the 3 daughters of one father in a single afternoon, and they had a story among themselves that when they were victorious in battle, the raven stretched his wings and seemed to fly, and that when they were defeated, he would droop. He had good reason to droop, now, if he could have done anything half so sensible, for King Alfred joined the Devonshire men, made a camp with them on a piece of firm ground in the midst of a bog in Somersetshire, and prepared for a great attempt for vengeance on the Danes, and the deliverance of his oppressed people. But, first, as it was important to know how numerous those pestilent Danes were, and how they were fortified, King Alfred, being a good musician, disguised himself as a gleeman or minstrel, and went, with his harp, to the Danish camp. He played and sang in the very tent of Guthrum the Danish leader, and entertained the Danes as they caroused. While he seemed to think of nothing but his music, he was watchful of their tents, their arms, their discipline, everything that he desired to know. And right soon did this great king entertain them to a different tune, for, summoning all his true followers to meet him at an appointed place, where they received him with joyful shouts and tears, as the monarch whom many of them had given up for lost or dead, he put himself at their head, marched on the Danish camp, defeated the Danes with great slaughter, and besieged them for 14 days to prevent their escape. But, being as merciful as he was good and brave, he then, instead of killing them, proposed peace, on condition that they should all together depart from that western part of England, and settle in the east, and that Guthrum should become a Christian, in remembrance of the divine religion which now taught his conqueror, the noble Alfred, to forgive the enemy who had so often injured him. This, Guthrum did. At his baptism, King Alfred was his godfather. And Guthrum was an honorable chief who well deserved that clemency, for, ever afterwards he was loyal and faithful to the king. The Danes under him were faithful too. They plundered and burned no more, but worked like honest men. They ploughed, and sowed, and reaped, and led good honest English lives. And I hope the children of those Danes played, many a time, with Saxon children in the sunny fields, and that Danish young men fell in love with Saxon girls, and married them, and that English travellers, benighted at the doors of Danish cottages, often went in for shelter until morning, and that Danes and Saxons sat by the red fire, friends, talking of King Alfred the Great. All the Danes were not like these under Guthrum, for, after some years, more of them came over, in the old plundering and burning way, ire among them a fierce pirate of the name of Hastings, who had the boldness to sail up the Thames to Gravesend, with 80 ships. For 3 years, there was a war with these Danes, and there was a famine in the country, too, and a plague, both upon human creatures and beasts. But King Alfred, whose mighty heart never failed him, built large ships nevertheless, with which to pursue the pirates on the sea, and he encouraged his soldiers, by his brave example, to fight valiantly against them on the shore. At last, he drove them all away, and then there was repose in England. As great and good in peace, as he was great and good in war, King Alfred never rested from his labors to improve his people. He loved to talk with clever men, and with travelers from foreign countries, and to write down what they told him, for his people to read. He had studied Latin after learning to read English, and now another of his labors was, to translate Latin books into the English Saxon tongue, that his people might be interested, and improved by their contents. He made just laws, that they might live more happily and freely. He turned away all partial judges, that no wrong might be done them. He was so careful of their property, and punished robbers so severely, that it was a common thing to say that under the great King Alfred, garlands of golden chains and jewels might have hung across the streets, and no man would have touched one. He founded schools, he patiently heard causes himself in his court of justice. The great desires of his heart were, to do right to all his subjects, and to leave England better, wiser, happier in all ways, than he found it. His industry in these efforts was quite astonishing. Every day he divided into certain portions, and in each portion devoted himself to a certain pursuit. That he might divide his time exactly, he had wax torches or candles made, which were all of the same size, were notched across at regular distances, and were always kept burning. Thus, as the candles burnt down, he divided the day into notches, almost as accurately as we now divide it into hours upon the clock. But when the candles were first invented, it was found that the wind and draughts of air, blowing into the palace through the doors and windows, and through the chinks in the walls, caused them to gutter and burn unequally. To prevent this, the king had them put into cases formed of wood and white horn. And these were the first lanthorns ever made in England. All this time, he was afflicted with a terrible unknown disease, which caused him violent and frequent pain that nothing could relieve. He bore it, as he had borne all the troubles of his life, like a brave good man, until he was 53 years old, and then, having reigned 30 years, he died. He died in the year 901, but, long ago as that is, his fame, and the love and gratitude with which his subjects regarded him, are freshly remembered to the present hour. In the next reign, which was the reign of Edward, surnamed the Elder, who was chosen in council to succeed, a nephew of King Alfred troubled the country by trying to obtain the throne. The Danes in the east of England took part with this usurper, perhaps because they had honored his uncle so much, and honored him for his uncle TMS' sake, and there was hard fighting, but, the king, with the assistance of his sister, gained the day, and reigned in peace for 24 years. He gradually extended his power over the whole of England, and so the seven kingdoms were united into one. When England thus became one kingdom, ruled over by one Saxon king, the Saxons had been settled in the country more than 450 years. Great changes had taken place in its customs during that time. The Saxons were still greedy eaters and great drinkers, and their feasts were often of a noisy and drunken kind, but many new comforts and even elegances had become known, and were fast increasing. Hangings for the walls of rooms, where, in these modern days, we paste up paper, are known to have been sometimes made of silk, ornamented with birds and flowers in needlework. Tables and chairs were curiously carved in different woods, were sometimes decorated with gold or silver, sometimes even made of those precious metals. Knives and spoons were used at table, golden ornaments were worn with silken cloth, and golden tissues and embroideries, dishes were made of gold and silver, brass and bone. There were varieties of drinking horns, bedsteads, musical instruments. A harp was passed round, at a feast, like the drinking bowl, from guest to guest, and each one usually sang or played when his turn came. The weapons of the Saxons were stoutly made, and among them was a terrible iron hammer that gave deadly blows, and was long remembered. The Saxons themselves were a handsome people. The men were proud of their long fair hair, parted on the forehead, their ample beards, their fresh complexions, and clear eyes. The beauty of the Saxon women filled all England with a new delight and grace. I have more to tell of the Saxons yet, but I stop to say this now, because under the great Alfred, all the best points of the English Saxon character were first encouraged, and in him first shown. It has been the greatest character among the nations of the earth. Wherever the descendants of the Saxon race have gone, have sailed, or otherwise made their way, even to the remotest regions of the world, they have been patient, persevering, never to be broken in spirit, never to be turned aside from enterprises on which they have resolved. In Europe, Asia, Africa, America, the whole world over, in the desert, in the forest, on the sea, scorched by a burning sun, or frozen by ice that never melts, the Saxon blood remains unchanged. Wheresoever the trace goes, there, law, and industry, and safety for life and property, and all the great results of steady perseverance, are certain to arise. I pause to think with admiration, of the noble king who, in his single person, possessed all the Saxon virtues, whom misfortune could not subdue, whom prosperity could not spoil, whose perseverance nothing could shake, who was hopeful in defeat, and generous in success, who loved justice, freedom, truth, and knowledge, who, in his care to instruct his people, probably did more to preserve the beautiful old Saxon language, than I can imagine, without whom, the English tongue in which I tell this story might have wanted half its meaning. As it is said that his spirit still inspires some of our best English laws, so, let you and I pray that it may animate our English hearts, at least to these to resolve, when we see any of our fellow creatures left in ignorance, that we will do our best, while life is in us, to have them taught, and to tell those rulers whose duty it is to teach them, and who neglect their duty, that they have profited very little by all the years that have rolled away since the year 901, and that they are far behind the bright example of King Alfred the Great. Chapter of Our England under Æthelstan and the Six Boy Kings. Æthelstan, the son of Edward the Elder, succeeded that king. He reigned only 15 years, but he remembered the glory of his grandfather, the great Alfred, and governed England well. He reduced the turbulent people of Wales, and obliged them to pay him a tribute in money, and in cattle, and to send him their best hawks and hounds. He was victorious over the Cornish men, who were not yet quite under the Saxon government. He restored such of the old laws as were good, and had fallen into disuse, made some wise new laws, and took care of the poor and weak. A strong alliance, made against him by Anlaf, a Danish prince, Constantine king of the Scots, and the people of North Wales, he broke and defeated in one great battle, long famous for the vast numbers slain in it. After that, he had a quiet reign, the lords and ladies about him had leisure to become polite and agreeable, and foreign princes were glad, as they have sometimes been since, to come to England on visits to the English court. When Æthelstan died, at 47 years old, his brother Edmund, who was only 18, became king. He was the first of six boy kings, as you will presently know. They called him the Magnificent, because he showed a taste for improvement and refinement. But he was beset by the Danes, and had a short and troubled reign, which came to a troubled end. One night, when he was feasting in his hall, and had eaten much and drunk deep, he saw, among the company, a noted robber named Leof, who had been banished from England. Made very angry by the boldness of this man, the king turned to his cupbearer, and said, "Hey, there is a robber sitting at the table yonder, who, for his crimes, is an outlaw in the land, a hunted wolf, whose life any man may take, at any time. Command that robber to depart." "I will not depart, ATM," said Leof. "Anno?" "ATM," cried the king. "Anno, by the Lord." "ATM," said Leof. Upon that the king rose from his seat, and, making passionately at the robber, and seizing him by his long hair, tried to throw him down. But the robber had a dagger underneath his cloak, and, in the scuffle, stabbed the king to death. That done, he set his back against the wall, and fought so desperately, that although he was soon cut to pieces by the king's armed men, and the wall and pavement were splashed with his blood, yet it was not before he had killed and wounded many of them. You may imagine what rough lives the kings of those times led, when one of them could struggle, half drunk, with a public robber in his own dining hall, and be stabbed in presence of the company who ate and drank with him. Then succeeded the boy King Edred, who was weak and sickly in body, but of a strong mind. And his armies fought the Northmen, the Danes, and Norwegians, or the Sea Kings, as they were called, and beat them for the time. And, in 9 years, Edred died, and passed away. Then came the boy King Edwy, 15 years of age, but the real king, who had the real power, was a monk named Dunstan, a clever priest, a little mad, and not a little proud and cruel. Dunstan was then abbot of Glastonbury Abbey, whither the body of King Edmund the Magnificent was carried, to be buried. While yet a boy, he had got out of his bed one night, being then in a fever, and walked about Glastonbury Church when it was under a bear, and, because he did not tumble off some scaffolds that were there, and break his neck, it was reported that he had been shown over the building by an angel. He had also made a harp that was said to play of itself, a which it very likely did, as Aetolian harps, which are played by the wind, and are understood now, always do. For these wonders he had been once denounced by his enemies, who were jealous of his favour with the late King Æthelstan, as a magician, and he had been waylaid, bound hand and foot, and thrown into a marsh. But he got out again, somehow, to cause a great deal of trouble yet. The priests of those days were, generally, the only scholars. They were learned in many things, having to make their own convents and monasteries on uncultivated grounds that were granted to them by the crown. It was necessary that they should be good farmers and good gardeners, or their lands would have been too poor to support them. For the decoration of the chapels where they prayed, And for the comfort of the refectories where they ate and drank, it was necessary that there should be good carpenters, good smiths, good painters, among them. For their greater safety in sickness and accident, living alone by themselves in solitary places, it was necessary that they should study the virtues of plants and herbs, and should know how to dress cuts, burns, scalds, and bruises, and how to set broken limbs. Accordingly, they taught themselves, and one another, a great variety of useful arts, and became skillful in agriculture, medicine, surgery, and handicraft. And when they wanted the aid of any little piece of machinery, which would be simple enough now, but was marvelous then, to impose a trick upon the poor peasants, they knew very well how to make it, and did make it many a time and often. I have no doubt, Dunstan, abbot of Glastonbury Abbey, was one of the most sagacious of these monks. He was an ingenious smith, and worked at a forge in a little cell. This cell was made too short to admit of his lying at full length when he went to sleep, as if that did any good to anybody. And he used to tell the most extraordinary lies about demons and spirits, who, he said, came there to persecute him. For instance, he related that one day when he was at work, the devil looked in at the little window, and tried to tempt him to lead a life of idle pleasure, whereupon, having his pincers in the fire, red hot, he seized the devil by the nose, and put him to such pain, that his bellowings were heard for miles and miles. Some people are inclined to think this nonsense a part of Dunstan's TMS madness, for his head never quite recovered the fever, but I think not. I observe that it induced the ignorant people to consider him a holy man, and that it made him very powerful. Which was exactly what he always wanted. On the day of the coronation of the handsome boy King Edwy, it was remarked by Odo, Archbishop of Canterbury, who was a Dane by birth, that the king quietly left the coronation feast, while all the company were there. Odo, much displeased, sent his friend Dunstan to seek him. Dunstan, finding him in the company of his beautiful young wife Elgiva, and her mother Ethelgiva, a good and virtuous lady, not only grossly abused them, but dragged the young king back into the feasting hall by force. Some, again, think Dunstan did this because the young king at TMS fair wife was his own cousin, and the monks objected to people marrying their own cousins, but I believe he did it, because he was an imperious, audacious, ill-conditioned priest, who, having loved a young lady himself before he became a sour monk, hated all love now, and everything belonging to it. The young king was quite old enough to feel this insult. Dunstan had been treasurer in the last reign, and he soon charged Dunstan with having taken some of the last king of TMS money. The Glastonbury abbot fled to Belgium, very narrowly escaping some pursuers who were sent to put out his eyes, as you will wish they had, when you read what follows, and his abbey was given to priests who were married, whom he always, both before and afterwards, opposed. But he quickly conspired with his friend, Odo the Dane, to set up the king of TMS' young brother, Edgar, as his rival for the throne, and, not content with this revenge, he caused the beautiful Queen Elgiva, though a lovely girl of only 17 or 18, to be stolen from one of the royal palaces, branded in the cheek with a red-hot iron, and sold into slavery in Ireland. But the Irish people pitied and befriended her, and they said, let us restore the girl queen to the boy king, and make the young lovers happy. And they cured her of her cruel wound, and sent her home as beautiful as before. But the villain Dunstan, and that other villain, Odo, caused her to be waylaid at Gloucester, as she was joyfully hurrying to join her husband, and to be hacked and hewn with swords, and to be barbarously maimed and lamed, and left to die. When Edwy the Fair, his people called him so, because he was so young and handsome, heard of her dreadful fate, he died of a broken heart, and so the pitiful story of the poor young wife and husband ends. Ah! Better to be two cottagers in these better times, than King and Queen of England in those bad days, though never so fair. Then came the boy king, Edgar, called the Peaceful, 15 years old. Dunstan, being still the real king, drove all married priests out of the monasteries and abbeys, and replaced them by solitary monks like himself, of the rigid order called the Benedictines.